You might have noticed that Pat and I are pretty fussy about our finances and our investments.
Yeah, a lot of junk doesn't make it past our bullshit detectors. But one thing that we've both used for many years is ShareSite. It records all dividends, franking credits, transactions, and performance easily in one place.
You can generate reports for income and capital gains, which makes tax time super easy. And ShareSite is completely free if you have 10 holdings or less.
So we've partnered with ShareSite to help support the podcast and provide all our listeners who upgrade to a paid plan a saving of 33% off the annual plan price. If you start with a free plan using our link, you'll still get that discount if you upgrade to a paid plan in the first 60 days.
Just head to ShareSite.com/fire and chill to get started.
Welcome to the Fire and Chill podcast, a collaboration between Dave from Strong Money Australia and Pat from Lifelong Shuffle, where we're going to have regular conversations about fire, investing, and living your best life.
Pat, how are you?
Yeah, good, man. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. What have you been up to the last couple of weeks?
Oh, geez. I actually helped my brother move today.
Oh, it was your brother?
Yeah, it was my brother. Ah. So that was fun.
Do people know that that was your old job? Do you reckon people know that? Like furniture removal?
No, people probably don't know I used to be a removalist.
Ah.
During university, I was a removalist. I worked in retail. I worked behind bars.
Retail?
Yeah, Kmart.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yeah.
I worked at Big W once.
Oh, nice.
How about that?
If you could call it work, I was in the Army Reserve for a fair while. And there was probably a bunch of other things I did too. So it wasn't always like, I wasn't always a high roller just earning tons of money, you know?
You had to progress to fat cat status.
Had to progress to fat cat status. Had to make my way there doing odd jobs and whatever I could, really.
Good stuff, mate.
Yeah. How about you? Was it just straight out of school into forklift driving?
So I had my Big W job when I was at school.
Yep.
And then kind of dropped out of school and did that Big W job a bit more. And then that's when I came over here to Perth from Victoria and started, you know, factory type work, and then it kind of went from there.
Yeah, very nice.
But no, we haven't been up to too much. Our dog actually he swallowed part of his toy about a week or so ago, so we had to take him to the vet. That was like the third time that's happened. And we got him this super, super hard toy, one that he's had before, and it lasted a few months last time before he even like broke any of it off. And this time, like within an hour, somehow he'd managed to break a part off. And usually he'll just like spit it out. But we, like, he obviously swallowed it, and we, like, where is it? We couldn't find it anywhere, and for some reason, he just decided to swallow it. So that was an expensive week. So
yeah.
But he's all right now, so that's the main thing. So that's good.
Yeah, very good.
All right, so we're doing a listener questions episode today, mate.
Yes, we are. This is our fourth one on this podcast, so that's not bad, eh?
I like doing these ones, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's nice. It's easy. We just get to speak our minds and answer some questions that some of our listeners might have.
Yeah. By the way, if you do have some questions that you would like Pat and I to answer on the show, you can email those through to fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And don't be shy. Don't have to worry about it being a silly question. There aren't really any silly questions. So just send those through and we'll get to them when we can. And just a little disclaimer before we get into today's questions. You know, this stuff is not personal advice. It's just a couple of blokes like sharing their thoughts and passing on some stuff that we might have learned over the years, just so you know.
Please don't email us asking for like very specific advice about your situation, because we really can't answer those sorts of questions. Just give general thoughts about different products mostly and different ways of looking at things.
Yeah, well said. All right, so do you want to kick us off, Pat?
Yeah, why not? Dave, what do we think of Ray Dalio and the all-weather portfolio?
Have you heard of this before? Have you heard of, you would have heard of Ray Dalio before, wouldn't you?
I've heard it in passing. I've never looked into him per se before this episode.
Have you heard about this portfolio, this all-weather portfolio?
Again, I've heard it in passing. I've never bothered looking into it, eh?
Okay.
Every time I hear about like a guru with some special portfolio, my eyes just glaze over. I'm just like, oh, here we go again. I don't want to waste my time looking into every crackpot's, you know, magic portfolio.
Especially when it's sometimes certain portfolios are kind of mentioned like there's that some sort of secret sauce attached to them, like it's the ultimate portfolio, you know?
Yeah. Is this one of those, eh?
Well, I mean, well, let's kind of get into it. So Ray Dalio is like a smart hedge fund guy who's been investing for a very long time. And from what I can tell, he's had pretty good long-term returns. And I mean, like in the terms of multiple decades, not just like 5 years or 10 years. And I think his fund is actually maybe the biggest hedge fund in the world, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But anyway, this all-weather portfolio, as it's called, is the idea behind it that he kind of, I guess he put it together and it was like given out as sort of like a recommendation of a portfolio that someone could hold and it will supposedly do well in all environments, or if not do well, it just won't do terribly in all sort of environments. So meaning it has different parts to it, which will be doing good at different times because of the way it's constructed. And it sounds pretty good in theory. And like historically, it's done all right. And so the portfolio is essentially 30% stocks, 15% is commodities and gold. And then 55% is like different types of bonds. So it might be like long-term bonds or intermediate bonds or whatever else. And so I've had this question asked on my blog as well. And I mean, I just don't like it at all. I mean, in the past, like bond yields were very high, as we've kind of discussed this in a previous episode, where a few decades ago, bond yields were like maybe 8%, 10% more than that even. And so this kind of portfolio might have done okay, and gold has a run every now and then, so sometimes that does okay. But right now, if you're putting half your portfolio in bonds, you've got to be expecting pretty low returns for a pretty long time. So you're kind of locking in pretty, I don't know, I would say pretty crappy returns. And I'm not a fan of gold either, which is something we've also covered on the podcast. So the only part I really like is like 30% stocks out of this whole portfolio. So I just don't like it at all. I don't think it will do any good. And it's possible that it's actually very likely that it's going to be a less volatile portfolio. But just because it's less volatile doesn't mean it will be a good long-term choice. It's definitely not something that I would invest in. What about you, Pat?
Right. So what you're saying is you like the 35% stocks. So if Ray
that's
could
the
just
only bit I like.
If Ray could just make the whole portfolio more of that, you would like the all-weather portfolio.
Nah, I'm just saying I only like the stock portion, so I don't like the portfolio.
I just would have to echo your thoughts. Bonds in particular, when the disclaimer comes up that past returns aren't indicative of future returns, that applies almost nowhere more than it applies to bonds. Like bonds, you can't just look at historical returns and think that those will be the average returns going forward for bonds. That's just not how the bond market works.
Yeah.
Right now, interest rates are extremely low. You buy those bonds at these low interest rates, the long-term expected outcome of those bonds are exactly the coupon rate you buy them at, basically.
And that's like an important thing to consider is the reason that is so is because bonds have no like growth function inside them. So stocks have, you know, company earnings, which grow over time. Real estate has rents, which grow over time. Bonds just have interest payments. That's it. There's no kind of growth component to them.
Yeah. And you lock that interest rate in when you buy the bond, essentially. Like you lock it in at that current interest rate so it doesn't go up over time. Yeah. Commodities and stuff. Oh, gold. Did we do an episode on gold?
Yeah, we did an episode. I can't remember what the number was, but it was called like other asset classes. Yeah, right.
Gold has just like done nothing for so long, and it's just been like these long cycles, and has it even kept up with inflation? I'm not even sure it's done that.
Not too sure, man. But if you compare it to stocks with dividends over a long time, it's pretty woeful.
Yeah, it's pretty woeful, yeah.
And then people hold gold because they're like, you know, when the economy collapses, that's when you want to earn gold. But, you know, from what I've read, it actually did pretty poorly if you held it during the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly.
And even now, oh, well, when the government prints lots of money, gold will do well, but that hasn't happened either.
No, that never, yeah.
So all these reasons for holding gold are just kind of fading away.
Yeah. And then you've only got this small 35% allocated to stocks, which is
30. I think it's 30.
Oh,
even
it's
less.
30. Stephen Less, geez, it's terrible.
Mm.
I don't like this portfolio at all either.
No.
Yet I think more generally, you're not going to find a secret sauce portfolio. There are no gurus, like, that no one really knows what's going to happen next. That's why we invest in index funds, or why Dave and I invest in sort of these index funds. It's just riding the wave of the market and planning conservatively enough that you can ride that wave, and just becoming mentally comfortable with that volatility, I'll say.
Yeah. But building a stronger stomach.
Yeah, building a stronger stomach, basically. And if you don't necessarily have that stronger stomach, then sure, maybe bonds can, you know, subdue that volatility.
Just don't invest as much. Just have a bit of cash or have a bit of bonds or whatever. Just don't invest all your money if you are a more nervous type.
Yeah, exactly. So this all-weather portfolio is just basically, hey, keep some of your money in a bank account.
Basically, yeah.
Same outcome.
Yeah. I suppose the thing is, you know, people who might be looking into a portfolio like this, they might have heard about it and they might have been interested in, like, what Ray Dalio is saying. People are looking for kind of a guru that is telling them what's going to happen, but no one can really tell you what's going to happen. You basically just have to, especially if you're on the road to financial independence, you essentially just have to ignore all these kind of guru type people and focus on building your investments and building your portfolio with the assets that are the most likely to give you a solid long-term return. And that's not going to be, it's not going to be bonds. It's not going to be gold or commodities. It's going to be the asset that always has the highest chance of delivering the better long-term return. And that's the stock market.
Yeah, pretty much. Good stuff, Dave. You got the next question.
All right. So this one's interesting, man. So, all right. What if the share market was open 24 hours a day, every single day of the year? Would this have an effect on individual portfolios in the long term? And a related question, what if markets were only open for 1 week each year?
Nice. So in short, I don't think this would have any long-term effect on portfolios. I still think over the long term, the market will return, whether it's open every day, 24 hours a day, or it's open once a week or once a year, the market will return what it returns long-term. All that would really happen is there would be like a lot more people losing sleep for no good reason. They'd be like staying up in the middle of the night, staring at like the share market on their phones.
You mean if it was open every day, like all day, every day?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then like big investment houses might need to like employ night crews.
Night shift.
Yeah, night shift crews. And all that's going to do is just like increase the fees. MERs.
Yeah, wow.
Without like meaningfully improving returns whatsoever.
Yeah, night shift. I never thought of that.
Night shift on the stock market. Yeah.
Nah, so I'm pretty much same as you. I don't think it would make any sort of long-term difference for individual investors whatsoever. And even in the short term, I don't see what kind of difference it would make. It's just more, I don't know, it just gives you more chance to, I mean, just because you can invest at night, is it going to make any sort of difference just because you can invest at nighttime and during the day? Our price is going to move that much differently than they do now? I wouldn't think so.
No. Nothing would change.
What about the second question then? What about if markets were only open 1 week per year? I think that one's really interesting.
I mean, you could say that it would reduce volatility, but that's kind of like a fake way of reducing volatility. It'll just like hide the volatility.
It's like if you sold your property once per year.
Yeah. If you had an auction outside your property once every year, you'd see a lot more volatility in your house price. Or if you sold your prop, like if you had an auction once a week in your front yard, you wouldn't get like this steady line upwards for the price of the house. Like it would kind of bounce around a little.
Yeah. So I reckon the markets would be, you wouldn't be seeing that volatility. It wouldn't be visible to you in real time, but the volatility in say like what the companies are actually doing, like their results, like their profits, that would still fluctuate as much as it does today. That wouldn't change because that's still happening at the end of the day. But yeah, like this only open 1 week per year. I think that's pretty interesting because long term, it wouldn't really make a difference again, I don't think, because companies are still going to do their thing. They're still going to make profits and pay dividends and whatever. It's not going to affect anything. But people might behave better in terms of their investments because they can only invest once per year. So you would think when they make that investment once per year, they have a long time to think about it and to be sure what they're going to invest in on that particular day. So you would think that people would be much less impulsive in what they were, what kind of shares they were buying. There would be none of this like buy, sell kind of nonsense that goes on. It would be more, there would be, you would be forced to think about it a bit more before you could actually pull the trigger and buy something.
Yeah, it might reduce volatility. God, it'd be annoying though, wouldn't it?
Be kind of fun for that one day. It'd be like Christmas, mate.
What if you missed it?
Where you just slept in?
Yeah, yeah. Like, oh shit, I've got no income this year. I need to go find a part-time job because I forgot to make my withdrawal.
It would definitely be less convenient if it was only open for 1 week per year or 1 day per year or whatever, you know? Because it's just something pretty cool about putting a little bit aside and then investing that each fortnight or month or whatever. So I mean, it could be the case that less people would invest because less people would put away, you know, money each week because they're like, oh, only once a year. So they wouldn't be as interested as if they could buy in smaller amounts like each month or whatever. Mm. I don't know.
Yep.
All right, what's the next question?
Dave, what are your thoughts on where one should be financially at different age and income brackets?
This is interesting. I've never been asked this question before, have you?
Oh, I get asked it from time to time.
Really?
Or it gets asked in like forums from time to time in particular.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I haven't really noticed that, but I have noticed some what I'll call clickbaity type articles about this topic. Like, oh, here's where you should be if you're, you know, 30 years old and you earn X amount. Here's how much you should have saved. Have you seen that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
definitely.
I hate this shit, man. It's so bad. It's really bad. And
whatever will get those clicks, Dave.
Oh.
Have I told you need to work on the episode titles of this podcast? We need more clicks.
What should we call this one?
Instead of listener questions, be like four facts that people just like you want to know about the stock market.
Number three will blow your mind. Here's, four questions that the finance industry won't answer for you.
Oh, yes, that's a good one. You're good at this.
Can't do it.
I was tempted to click on that, but then I noticed and I was like, nah.
I can't make that the title, mate, because I still have to sleep at night. All right, that's a look. So back to this question, where should people be at different ages and income brackets? I really don't like this question because the whole purpose of the question is to compare. And what are you going to actually gain by comparing? You're either going to feel great that you're better than other people, which, I mean, fine if that's how you want to feel, but it's not all that healthy. Or you're going to feel miserable because other people are doing better than you. And you're going to feel like you don't stack up and it'll create anxiety and whatever. So it's not all that healthy either way you look at it. So there's so many different scenarios of why people might be a bit further along than you or a bit further behind than you. So they might have higher or lower income. They might have more or less kids, more or less loans than you. They might have done more or less study, entered the workforce earlier or later. They might have had a poorer or richer upbringing. They might have a higher cost of living, lower cost of living. There's just unlimited amount of reasons why people are at different stages in their lives due to no fault of their own or whatever. So it doesn't make sense to me. And when you really think about it, it's not that helpful because someone with like 400 grand of income, say, and 400 grand of wealth, like it sounds awesome, or they might be earning such and such and they've got this much wealth, but they're actually poorer than someone who only spends 50 grand a year and has 200 grand of wealth. So even when you break it down into little metrics like that, it's still not that helpful. So like the second person's actually killing it relative to the first person, even though their numbers are lower. So I don't know, man. I just have real beef with this kind of question of this playing this comparison game because it's not, I don't think it's the right way to go about it. What do you think?
You don't think it might motivate someone to?
Yeah, but it's going to motivate them from a position of anxiety, not from a position of like internal motivation and like actually wanting to achieve something for themselves. It's going to be because they're miserable that they don't compare to other people, which is just sad.
But what if that's the only way some people get motivated? Like what if that's their rub?
Then they're probably just going to keep chasing different levels into the future and fear and anxiety is going to be the only thing that drives them because once they get to that stage, they're probably going to compare themselves to someone who's further along and the cycle is just going to repeat itself. And so they're spending years and years and years of their lives in this state of kind of anxiety and striving and never getting anywhere because they would just keep moving the goalposts.
Or they'll just keep like asking the question until they find the answer they want to hear and then they'll feel good about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, the one that finally makes them feel good about themselves.
It's like, yeah, see, I'm doing okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then what? But then what? So what? You feel okay. Are you going to relax now? Are you going to keep doing the same thing or what? It doesn't change anything. That's the problem. So what? So you're doing better. So you're doing worse. So what?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like it. What do you think?
It is meaningless. You've hit the nail on the head. It's what's the point? What does it get you? Okay, the other guy has 50K more than you. What are you going to do about it?
Once you start comparing, you've already lost the game. Like, just, nah, yeah. No good.
It's kind of the same as, like, comparing your house and your car to the person next door to you.
Yeah. It's just a different version of that.
Yeah, it's a different metric.
Yeah.
You should probably be saving for your own reasons and your own, you know, goals, and instead of trying to compare yourself to someone next door to yourself.
Yeah. Well, everything's relative. Like, the amount you need is only relative to your, like, the amount of investments you need is only relative to your kind of personal situation and what your personal goals are. Not everyone has the same goals. Not everyone has the same needs in their lives. So
yeah,
it's just a slippery slope, I think.
Yeah, with the millions of permutations, as you said.
Yeah. Good luck putting all that shit in a spreadsheet.
Oh. All right. Let's move on.
All right. So the next one, I'll pose it to you, Pat. It's generally about how to treat a financial windfall. So here's the question. I've recently discovered FIRE and have been binging FIRE and Chill. Thanks for putting your time into this project. It's a great resource. I've always been good with money, and it turns out I've been on the FIRE journey without really realizing it. I run a business with a couple of other guys, and we've recently just distributed $100,000 each. I was just hoping to pick your brain regarding how you would treat such a large influx of cash. So I appreciate the benefits of dollar cost averaging, and I wonder if it would be reckless to throw all of this into the market at once. But on the flip side, I see $100,000 sitting in an offset account, not working as hard as it could be.
Yeah, this is a super common question.
Very common, yeah, man.
And the package response or the rehearsed response at this point is so fine-tuned that almost anyone can give it to you, but we'll deliver it anyway. Yeah. Yes, you are far more likely to have a better result if you just throw all the money in at once. So right now, $100,000. Throw it into the market. On average, you're going to do better than DCA, I think over 66% of the time or over 68% of the time, something like that.
And why is that?
So the reason that is because on average, the market goes up over time. So the sooner you can invest, the more chance there is of your money growing over time. However, the market is also volatile. So there is a chance that you invest now and then the market dips or crashes, you know, within the next, say, 6 months or a year. Whereas if you decided to DCA over 6 months or a year, you would have done better in those smaller number of scenarios where there was a dip or a crash right after investing.
And so just in case anyone's not aware, DCA is dollar cost averaging, which is essentially just drip feeding your money into the market like a little bit each month or each whatever period you choose until it's gone. Yeah, so I can't really add anything to that, Pat. You've pretty much nailed it, man. I mean, the only other thing is like the psychological aspect of it and like trying to reduce regret. So obviously, like if you're investing a lump sum all at once, that's kind of a big deal. So there's a lot more emotion that may come into play if the market then falls after you've put all the money in. You'll be feeling like you'll wish that you hadn't done that. And so because it was such a all or nothing decision, there's a lot more kind of emotional downside, I suppose you could call it, that could come from that decision. And so by putting it in each month or whichever period you choose, it smooths out the result a lot. So if the market goes down, you can actually feel good because when you're putting in this money each month, it's actually going to buy more shares. And if the market's going up, you know, it's probably not going to go up that much each month. So you're probably still going to be psychologically pretty comfortable putting money in each month. So it's just easier psychologically, I think, if you dollar cost average, but the numbers do say that you do generally end up better off if you are to put it in all at once. So I don't really think there's a right answer. In the past, I've actually gone like 50-50. So I've put in like half of it straight away. And then I've also dollar cost averaged the other half. And I found that to be like pretty good. Like when you can't decide which method to choose, you're like, well, I'll put half in and then I'll drip feed the rest. And then you kind of, I don't know. It's kind of like making a decision without making a decision. you get some of the benefits and some of the drawbacks of each. So I kind of enjoyed that.
Path of least regret.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. What do you think about that? I quite enjoyed it at the time when I did it.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a bad strategy if you're uncomfortable with investing it all at once. I also think that a lot of people will just say, oh, put it all in at once and just... that will, on average, lead to the best results. Therefore, you should put it all in at once. But when we think about it, we don't always do what will, on average, lead to the best results. Like, we all know that a 100% share portfolio will, on average, lead to the best results. Yet, many of us keep an emergency fund, or many of us keep a bond allocation, or many of us keep, like, money in an offset separate from our share portfolio. Even though we should all know by now that on average, the best results come from investing 100% in the share market, why do we do this? Why do we put, say, 5 or 10% in an offset account, Dave? What are we doing there?
Because you're a human, not a robot.
Well, that's true. But one of the reasons we do it is because the average sometimes doesn't matter when you're trying to control risk. So yes, on average, you will do better by throwing it all in at once. However,
but sometimes you don't.
So, you know, in the real world, we have something called insurance, right? In the normal world. If you don't know this already, I'm going to share a little secret with you. On average, when you buy insurance, you are losing money. Like, on average, most people will lose money buying insurance. The expected outcome is negative at the end of your life paying insurance. So why do you pay insurance? Control risk. We all do this. I do it. We've all had some sort of insurance, surely, in our adult lives. I find DCA is the same as buying insurance. Like, you are accepting a lower return over the next 12 months to control the extreme outcome of a market crash straight after you invest the lump sum. So, for example, if you invest over a 12-month period and in month two there's a market crash, woohoo, your insurance worked. And you get, you know, 10 months of low returns. If it doesn't happen, well, you've given up a few percentage points of return, but you've controlled that risk in the meantime. There's also the scenario where you could end your DCA of 12 months and then the market crashes after that.
Yeah.
And people kind of say this as a reason why, well, DCA doesn't work anyway, because it could just crash after you make your final installment. But that's not quite true, because you've then had, say, on average, 6 months of returns for your portfolio before the crash happened. So again, the negative outcome has been reduced, the amplitude of it. I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way. Like, I don't mind people controlling risk as long as they know they're paying a price for controlling risk. And that's fine.
Yeah, there's no right answer to these types of questions. And that's half the time that's why it's asked, because there's no obvious answer that's the clear winner. That's why the question exists in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. And just to continue on this analogy, the longer you stretch out the DCA period, the more you're paying for that insurance. So you're giving up more returns for the greater risk control. However, when you squeeze that up down to, say, 3 months, you're paying less for less risk control, say, and when the ultimate scenario is just put it all in at once, so you're paying zero for that risk control.
So with a lump of cash, the longer you take to invest that lump of cash, the more you can expect on average to lose in returns that you would have got if you had to put it all in at the start. So you don't want it to be like, you don't want to be stretching it out for, like, you know, 3-4 years or whatever. It starts getting pretty, the opportunity cost there starts to get pretty extreme.
Yeah, exactly. So how would you do this, Dave, if you got 200K today?
Well, actually, there's another angle we can think about, is if I was working full time and I was earning normal kind of income, and so I was saving a few thousand dollars each month and investing regularly, and I was building my portfolio for financial independence, I would probably invest all of this upfront. Because if I already had an emergency fund, I was already saving and investing every month, then there's no real need for me to spread that money out, because if I put it all in at once and the market goes down after that, I'm still saving and investing every month anyway. So I still have the chance, or I still have the ability every month to be buying shares at lower prices. It's not like I put in that lump and then that's it, I can't invest after that. So it depends on your situation as well in terms of what's your kind of monthly surplus that you're able to put in the market as well.
Yeah.
That can change the decision, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. I think I would just throw it all in at this point because 100K, it's a lot of money, but compared to the size of my portfolio now, it's not a huge amount. You know what I mean? Yeah. So 100K for someone who has $0, 100K is probably this huge amount of money.
Oh, overwhelmingly large in the beginning. Yeah, for sure.
Overwhelmingly large. But the more wealth you build, the smaller those windfalls or lump sums seem.
Yeah. And so that's another way to put it as well. Like if your portfolio is currently like $10,000 and you've only just started investing, then throwing another $100,000 into the market, regardless of what the numbers say, you're probably not going to be too comfortable with that. But if your portfolio is already $600,000 or $700,000 and you're adding an extra $100,000, it's a lot more, like you're going to be a lot more comfortable than the person who's just starting out. So there's so many things that can go into it.
Yeah, a lot of factors that play into the psychology of the person investing, really.
Yeah, definitely. That's it, man.
Yeah, that was a nice short one, I think.
Man, that was quick.
All right, that's all we've got for this listener questions episode. Again, if you've got a question for us or a topic suggestions, please send those through to fireandchillpod@gmail.com. And if you want to check out some more content from us, you can find me at lifelongshuffle.com and Dave at strongmoneyaustralia.com. We appreciate you guys tuning in. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there now, so thanks for choosing us. We appreciate it. Take care. We'll talk to you next time.